So last week we left off towards the end of Joshua chapter 8. We looked at God's promise, God's plan for the battle, which was ambush and annihilation. And we talked about how they had set some and then added some more. So there was probably about a total of 35,000 that were in ambush on the west side of the city. So verse 18 of chapter 8 is where we're going to pick up. The Lord said unto Joshua, stretch out the spear that is in thy hand toward Ai. Now, isn't that interesting? Joshua didn't have to guess, figure, wonder, when is the time for me to, give the signal. The Lord said, okay, now, this is the time. So Joshua stretched out his spear. Verse 19, the ambush rose quickly out of their place, and they ran as soon as he had stretched out his hand, and they entered into the city and took it and hasted and set the city on fire. When the men of Ai looked behind them and they saw, behold, the smoke of the city ascended up to heaven, they had no power to flee this way or that. Then the people that fled to the wilderness turned back upon the pursuers. And when Joshua and all Israel saw the ambush had taken the city, the smoke of the city ascended, then they turned again and slew the men of Ai. And the other issued out of the city against them. So they were in the midst of Israel, some on this side and some on that side, and they smote them so that they let none of them remain or escape. And the king of Ai they took alive and brought him to Joshua. And when Israel had made an end of slaying all the inhabitants of Ai in the field, in the wilderness wherein they chased them, and when they were all fallen on the edge of the sword until they were consumed, that all the Israelites returned to Ai and smote it with the edge of the sword. Now, if you are paying attention to any of the timeline details here, you might have a couple of questions. Verse 19 says they set the city on fire. And then in the middle of it, it says the ones that set the city on fire came out and kind of made a pincher or a vice, kind of you have in front and behind, and then the men of Ai, and as we read later, Ai and Bethel together, those men were kind of caught in between two groups of Israel with nowhere to run. But then there at the end, at verse 24, it says they smote it with the edge of the sword. So the Jewish historians were not always in the habit of putting everything chronologically. So we could chalk it up to that. But it almost seems to me like maybe they set a fire at the gate of the city so nobody could get out, went to the battle, and then they came back and finished off. I don't know. But I mean, the order that it's written here, it says that they set the city on fire, and then they went and killed all the soldiers, and then they came back and killed the rest of them that were in the city. How all that works, I don't know. Probably nobody cares but me, but I wonder about those things sometimes. But, that's kind of the sequence of events. So when they sought God first and had God's direction, the battle went much more favorably to them. And everybody says, duh, right? I mean, obviously, that's kind of what you would expect. I say that because, we are more prone than we should be to, oh, I got this. I've seen this. I can handle this. I know how to do this. And we, rush into something, just like they made the decision to go into Ai. We don't need to do this. We'll just send a small army and take them out. Well, they didn't ask the Lord's direction, and it cost them. This time, the Lord says, send everybody. They sent everybody. They, laid a trap. They fled, drew them out, and then killed them, and it was, highly successful. We're going to see the same theme again in chapter 9. But, defeat happens when you don't consult God. Okay? In chapter 7, sending people against Ai, was that sinful in and of itself? No. I mean, that's what God had told them to do. In chapter 9, was making a peace treaty between nations, was that inherently sinful? No. But God had told them not to make treaties with the nations around. But in both chapter 7 and chapter 9, we see that when they just decided, hey, I got this under control, I'm going to make my own decision, I'm going to go with it, it blew up in their face. So here we see that however the sequence of event happened, they set the city on fire. Now, verse 26 says, Joshua drew not his hand back, wherewith he stretched out the spear until he had utter destroyed the inhabitants of Ai. Verse 27, only the cattle And the spoil of that city Israel took for a prey unto themselves, according to the word of the Lord, which he commanded Joshua. Now again, the only difference with Jericho and Ai, they were in both cases told to destroy everybody. The difference was in Jericho, the spoil belonged to the Lord. In Ai, they were allowed to keep the spoil. But again, here's my question. What spoil was left after they set the city on fire? You know, basically, only the things that would survive a fire, most likely. So the gold, the silver, the iron and brass and those kinds of things, which would have been very valuable for making axes and plows and weapons and whatever, you know, there would have been some things that would have survived the fire. But, you know, there were not going to be likely, you know, there was not a nice heirloom china hutch that was going to be salvageable, you know. The woodworking shop is not going to be like, ooh, I want this one. You know, that's all gone, okay? So why did that happen? I mean, now let me just take a time out here. Did Israel lack for God's provision with the spoils that they got from the land?
Not at all.
Okay, but they missed out on something that they could have had because they didn't ask the Lord's direction before they went into Ai. God could have given them a different battle plan and, you know, they may or may not have had to burn it before they spoiled it. I mean, they may have burned a lot of these cities after they spoiled it, you know. But nonetheless, it does say the cattle they would have had, which makes sense because usually the cities were not near as large as we think of cities today inside the wall. You know, the inside the wall was basically just dwelling places and a safe refuge. There, all the farmland and the grazing land and all of that was outside the walls. And a lot of times, just like David, he would stay out with the sheep at night. When the angels came to see the shepherds to announce the birth of Jesus, they were near Bethlehem, but they weren't inside the city walls. They were out in the fields, you know. And so that was fairly common. So that the cattle makes a lot more sense to me. But when it says they took the spoil, it really just makes me wonder, you know, even though they were allowed to keep it, what other than the animals would have been left for them to keep? Verse 27 says, they took the spoil for themselves according to the word of the Lord. So this was God's command. This was what God had told them. Verse 28, Joshua burnt Ai and made it a heap forever, even a desolation unto this day. And the king of Ai, he hanged on a tree until eventide, and as soon as the sun was down, Joshua commanded they should take his carcass down from the tree and cast it at the entering of the gate of the city and raise thereon a great heap of stones that remaineth unto this day. So again, these references in Joshua unto this day refer to the time of the writing. Okay, that doesn't mean until, you know, 2024 AD, but rather at the time the book of Joshua was written, that was still the circumstance. So the soldiers killed everybody else. They brought the king to Joshua. Joshua executed the king of Ai. And, you know, the law of Moses says what about someone that was hanged on a tree? Cursed, right? I mean, that's referenced with Jesus, you know, later on in the New Testament as well. So it was in the eyes of Israel anyway, a dishonorable death. Okay? Now, we hear the term king and we think, whoa, okay, you know, big, important, you know, whatever. But he was the king of Ai. And there was a king of Jericho and there was a king of Gibeah and there was a king of Bethel. You know, a lot of these cities had kings. So it was not like later on with David and Solomon and all of the descendants where they were king over vast territories. I mean, the way our terminology would go today, it was more like, the king was more like the mayor of the city with autonomy kind of thing. You know, just a different type of setup. We're going to see in the first part of chapter 9 that there were the kings of several cities that banded together to try to fight against Joshua and Israel. But nonetheless, you know, this was their leader. This was their military and political leader. And then in the last part of Joshua chapter 8, verses 31 through 35, we see a review of the law. Verse 30, Joshua built an altar unto the Lord in Mount Ebal. And Moses, the servant of the Lord, commanded the children of Israel, as it is written in the book of the law of Moses, an altar of whole stones, over which no man had lift up any iron, and they offered thereon burnt offerings unto the Lord and sacrificed peace offerings. And he wrote there upon the stones a copy of the law of Moses, which he wrote in the presence of the children of Israel. Now, we read that and go, oh, okay, that's neat. They wrote a copy of the law. Well, what was the law of Moses? Exodus, half of it. I mean, Exodus 19, they're at Mount Sinai, and then starting in Exodus chapter 20, God gives them the Ten Commandments and the rest of the laws. So you got a good chunk of Exodus, a good chunk of Leviticus, and some of it Numbers too. How long would it have taken him to write that if he wrote all of it? I mean, it's very possible that it was a condensed version, But nonetheless, when we say, oh, he wrote there a copy of the law, it's just like, okay, whatever. It's not like he put it on the copy machine and hit the button. Now, it says he wrote it on the stones. Does that mean they used that as a tabletop and wrote it down on parchment? Or does that mean they're chiseling it into the stones? Could be either one. I tend to think that they were writing a copy of it, not necessarily chiseling it into the stone. But nonetheless, this was something that we kind of buzz through if we do our Bible reading and that kind of thing, that this was, a long event. Okay, this is multiple hours and that kind of thing. But I want you to hold your place here in Joshua chapter 8 and turn back with me just a few pages to Deuteronomy 27. This absolutely had been commanded. At the end of Deuteronomy, Moses was giving instructions to Joshua. He said, I'm going to be gone. You're taking him into the land. I'm not allowed to go into the land. And here's your instructions. Deuteronomy 27, verse number 1. Moses with the elders of Israel commanded the people, saying, keep the commandments which I command you this day. And it shall be on the day when you shall pass over Jordan unto the land which the Lord thy God giveth thee, that thou shalt set thee up great stones and plaster them with plaster. And thou shalt write upon them all the words of this law when thou art passed over. Now, what does that sound like? Okay, that doesn't sound like chiseling, but that does sound like writing them on the stones. Okay? That thou mayest, when thou hast passed over, that thou mayest go into the land which the Lord thy God giveth thee, a land that floweth with milk and honey, as the Lord God of thy fathers hath promised thee. Therefore it shall be, when you have gone over Jordan, ye shall set up these stones which I command you this day in Mount Ebal, and thou shalt plaster them with plaster. And there thou shalt build an altar unto the Lord thy God, an altar of stones. Thou shalt not lift up any tool of iron upon them. Sound familiar? It's quoted in Joshua. Verse 6, thou shalt build the altar of the Lord thy God of whole stones. Thou shalt offer burnt offerings thereon unto the Lord thy God. Thou shalt offer peace offerings, and shalt eat there, and rejoice before the Lord thy God. And thou shalt write upon the stones all the words of this law, very plainly. In another place in Deuteronomy, it was they were told to set the congregation, part of the group on Mount Ebal and part on Mount Gerizim. And they were to read the blessings and the cursings. And one group repeated the blessings and the other one repeated the cursings. But it was kind of like a visual representation. If you do good, this is what happens. If you do evil, this is what happens. And you had that good, bad, yes, no, kind of that back and forth visually represented. But God had commanded Joshua through Moses to do this very thing. So we kind of, pass over it when we're, you're reading Joshua. We tend to think, okay, the battle at Ai and they got to keep the spoil and all those kinds of things. That was the main point. When really, this is just as significant, this last section of Joshua chapter 8. I'm back in Joshua chapter 8 now, verse 33. And all Israel and their elders and officers and judges stood on this side the ark and on that side before the priests and Levites which bear the ark of the covenant of the Lord, as well the stranger as he that was born among them, half of them over against Mount Gerizim, half of them over against Mount Ebal. Now, not necessarily all the way up on the top of the mountain, but that was the two sides. One group over here, one group over here. As Moses, the servant of the Lord, had commanded them that they should bless the people of Israel. And afterwards he read all the words of the law, the blessings and cursings, according to all that is written in the book of the law. There was not a word of all that Moses commanded, which Joshua read not before all the congregation of Israel, with the women and the little ones and the strangers that were conversant among them. Okay, so if you were to complain that Pastor Davidson preached too long, it could have been longer, right? This was a long service. I mean, even if you just go look at Alexander Scorby and try to estimate, okay, how long would it take? How long is the actual audio of reading the book of Leviticus? You know, just it took a few hours to do all of that. So this was a solemn time. And what do you think was the purpose of this reviewing of the law? Why would they have been commanded to do this? Really? That much, huh? Yeah. Yep, the younger generation had not witnessed, you know, Mount Sinai in the same way. That's a very good reason. Any others? Yeah, because our forgetter works better than our rememberer, right? They need a reminder. Absolutely. Absolutely. Why was God destroying Jericho and Ai and Bethel? Did God say, it's because you're the greatest, wonderfulest people on the face of the earth? Obviously, I know that's poor grammar. In fact, what did God tell Israel? I didn't pick you because you were the biggest or the most important. I picked you because you were smallest and insignificant so that it would be known that I did this. All right? I'm paraphrasing a little bit, but that's what God told them, right? He said, I'm picking you because you're nobody so that when something good happens, they have to know that it was your God that did it. See, God was not blessing them just because they were super special. God was blessing them because He had chosen to and because the glory of God was to be seen in them. So this is also a reminder that, hey, the crossing of the Jordan and the conquering of Jericho and the defeat of Ai, eventually Ai and Bethel, they came together. This chapter 8 here tells us that it's about a total of 12,000 men combined between Ai and Bethel, so it had been more than that with women and children. But these early victories, at this point, they had to stop and remember, look, God is doing this, number one, so that He would get glory. Number two, because the people, the inhabitants of the land had worshipped idols. And they had offended God. And it was partly judgment on them, as well as God's blessing on Israel. But at the same time, what was God's warning to Israel? Don't you do what they did. Don't you learn to worship their idols. Don't you adopt their practices. So all of these things go into the reminders that they needed. But this review of the law is obedience to what God had commanded them. It was a reminder for the purpose of what was going on. It was a testimony to this younger generation that the same God that brought them out of Egypt, that brought their parents out of Egypt, was going to give them the land that He'd promised them. You know, all of that is wrapped up in it here in the last section of Joshua chapter 8, all right? So then that brings us to Joshua chapter 9, which I'm calling a preventable mistake. A preventable mistake. Why? Okay, you know it anyway, but verse 14, the men took of their victuals, and here's the key phrase, asked not counsel at the mouth of the Lord. That's why I say it was preventable. Okay? The main story, there's two or three pieces here, but the main story in Joshua chapter 9 is they made a peace treaty with people they never should have agreed with. Why? Because they didn't pray about it. They didn't ask for God's direction. All right, now let's back up to the beginning of the chapter. Verse number 1, it came to pass when all the kings which were on this side Jordan in the hills and in the valleys and all the coasts of the great sea over against Lebanon, all the Ites, the Hittites, Amorites, Canaanites, Perizzites, Hivites, Jebusites, when they heard thereof, they gathered themselves together to fight with Joshua and with Israel with one accord. Again, now when it says all the kings, that's primarily, they were the king over one city. At most, you know, somebody might be king over a group of people that was a handful of cities. But all of these Ites were in a smaller area than what David would eventually rule over as the king of Israel. Okay, so you got all of these, you know, regional rulers, all of these kings, that they're coming together to fight with Joshua and Israel with one accord. What does that mean? All right, we're going to set aside our differences for now. All of us have one goal right now, and that's survival. So there's two ways to look at that. Number one is, uh-oh, we got a problem. There's a bunch of them now. There's another way to look at it. Great, you just made our job easier. We don't have to chase you all over the country. You're all in one spot now. I mean, there's more than one perspective on this thing here, but that's the backdrop, and we'll come back to that in chapter 10, okay, or later part of chapter 9 and chapter 10. The backdrop is all of the inhabitants of Canaan, I'm just going to call them Canaanites because they all lived in the land of Canaan, even though there's a bunch of other descriptive titles for them here. All the ites got together and said, look, if we don't join together, none of us individually are going to be able to fight against these people and win. So amid that backdrop then, verse 3, Gibeon makes a different choice. Okay, so we see here, first of all, in the first two verses, the gathering of the Canaanites. And then we see the guile of the Gibeonites. All right, verse 11 of chapter 9 talks about our elders and the inhabitants of our country told us to do this. It's interesting to me, it may just be an omission, but there's never mentioned a king of the Gibeonites. You know, there was kings of these other cities. There's never mentioned a king of the Gibeonites. So that could mean that they, you know, they weren't part of this other coalition because they didn't have a king that, you know, signed them up for that. But nonetheless, the Gibeonites, and there's two names that sound very similar. Okay, Gibeon with an N is what we're dealing with here. Anybody remember the hometown of King Saul? Gibeah. It has an H on the end of it. So there's Gibeah and there's Gibeon. And Gibeah has an A-H. This one has an O in it. But the Gibeonites decided, there's no way we're going to beat these people. We're going to try to trick them. All right, verse 4, they did work wilily. That's a good word, isn't it? Any of you use that in a sentence this week? Probably not. Okay, I mean, some of you might think, you know, when you hear that, wily coyote. Only in that scenario, who was the wily one? Wily coyote was always the butt of the jokes. The wily one, that word wily means crafty, shrewd, sharp. In fact, that word is used negatively as guile or crafty. It's the same word in Genesis 3:1 that says the serpent was more subtle than any beast of the field. Okay, so subtlety is used in a negative connotation. It's also used, this same word is also used in a positive connotation. Proverbs chapter 1, verse 4 says one of the purposes of Proverbs is to give subtlety to the simple, you know, to give some discernment, you know, to give some awareness. So this same word is translated as prudence or wisdom or subtlety. Proverbs 22:3 is, I say, one of my favorite verses, not because it sounds amazing, it's just because I need it. Proverbs 22:3, and it's repeated twice in Proverbs, but it says this, a prudent man foreseeth the evil and hideth himself, but the simple pass on and are punished. Okay? I mean, when I try to illustrate that, I do that frequently with college students. I try to say, look, you ever been walking through the woods behind somebody? Okay, and you're walking behind them and they push a limb out of their way and then they keep going. What's getting ready to happen? It's getting ready to snap back, right? So the prudent man sees what's happening, steps back, lets the limb come, and then goes forward. The simple man walks right into it, like Wile E. Coyote would have, okay? But it says here that they worked wilily. That this word is used both positively and negatively, but it has the idea of to be crafty, to be subtle, to use wisdom and use discernment. Okay, in this case, though, the intent was not to improve their situation. Honestly, the intent was deceit. So they did work wily and went and made as if they'd been ambassadors and took old sacks upon their asses and wine bottles, old and rent and bound up. Now again, the word rent there doesn't mean, you know, like U-Haul truck, they, you know, checked it out for a week. It means torn, okay? And old shoes clouded upon their feet. As I understand it, that word clouded means patched or repaired, and old garments upon them, and all the bread of their provision was dry and moldy. And they went to Joshua unto the camp at Gilgal, unto them and to the men of Israel, and they said, "We be come from a far country. Now therefore make ye a league with us." And the men of Israel said unto the Hivites, now there you're given, they're given a different name. Gibeon was their city. Hivite was their ethnicity. So it's the same group of people. "Peradventure you dwell among us, and how shall we make a league with you?" And they said unto Joshua, "We are thy servants." You notice they didn't answer that question. What if you actually just live right around the corner from here and we just don't know the map well enough yet? And they said, "Hey, we're your servants." They didn't confirm or deny, did they? We're your servants. Verse 8, "And Joshua said unto them, Who are you? And whence come are ye?" And from whence come ye? And they said unto him, "From a very far country thy servants are come, because of the name of the Lord thy God. For we have heard of the fame of him, and all that he did in Egypt, and all that he did to the two kings of the Amorites that were beyond Jordan, Sihon king of Heshbon, and Og king of Bashan, which was at Ashtaroth. Wherefore our elders and all the inhabitants of our country spake to us, saying, Take victuals with you for the journey." Now this is interesting. They mentioned the name of their God, kind of a form of flattery. But also, what battles did they mention? Sihon and Og, those are actually recorded in Deuteronomy. Moses was still with Israel at that time. They came up to the border of the land while Moses was still alive. They defeated Sihon and Og, and they were part of the giants. Those were inhabitants on the east side of the Jordan River. But again, that was a testimony to them that, yes, God will keep his promises. God will give you the rest of the land and all of that. But chronologically, those battles happened a couple months ago. You know, what did they leave out strategically? Jericho, Ai, Bethel. They left those things out. Were they unaware of that? Mm-mm. They left out the crossing of the Jordan and those kind of things. So again, they've rehearsed their story pretty well. Okay? Verse 11 again, "Wherefore elders and inhabitants of our country spake to us, saying, Take victuals with you for the journey, and go to meet them, and say unto them, We are your servants. Therefore now make ye a league with us." All right, so you see the guile of the Gibeonites. Old clothes, worn out shoes, wine bottles that had burst. Why was that significant? Because they would put them in leather bottles, pouches. And as the natural fermentation process would happen, it would give off gases. And so, you know, that would add pressure, and eventually, you know, if it wasn't, you know, vented properly, it would cause them to pop. Now, none of that makes any sense if you stop and think about it. You're telling me that those bottles burst because they brought them to use on the trip and they never once opened it the whole trip. I mean, you try to, if you have like a 2-liter bottle of a carbonated drink, you know, you try to keep the lid on as much as possible because you're going to lose that, right? But if you pour some, put the cap back on it, eventually you're going to lose that. Not the same process, but similar idea, okay? You're telling me that they came from 2 months travel away and they didn't even touch this, you know, drink that they brought with them before it burst? All right, now, ladies, let me ask you this. If the last little bit of bread in the bag or the container gets moldy, do you hang on to it for show and tell? What are you doing with it? You're tossing it. Now, the men are more likely to hang on to it a little longer. I wouldn't just cut the corner off of it and eat the rest of it, you know. But eventually, they're going to throw it out too, right? Okay, don't tell on yourself there, Brother Jim. If you get the heat up to a certain temperature, it kills the mold, and then you can still eat. Okay. So, why in the world, what reasonable person would have kept the moldy bread? Does that make any sense? I mean, even guys that aren't the best at housekeeping, eventually they would have thrown out the moldy bread and bought some more along the way, right? Hey, my wife baked this for me the day we left, and it smelled so good, I just decided to smell it for a couple of weeks and not eat it. What guy on the face of the earth is going to say that? Right? If you stop and use a little bit of common sense, this story can fall apart real quick. Why in the world would you have bread from 3 weeks ago or a month ago? I mean, you know, I realize there's all kinds of takes out there, and I don't want to get into a health food discussion. I just wanted to point out, if you make homemade bread versus a loaf of bread from the store that has more preservatives in it, which one will last longer before it starts to... I mean, the store-bought bread will last longer because the preservatives they put in it to help prevent that. You get homemade bread, does it last a week? Not usually. Okay? That's what we're talking about. We're talking about homemade bread. And if they really came from, our shoes were new when we left, and look at the holes in the bottom, you know? Look at this. You know, our clothes got worn out, but I still have this biscuit my wife made me before I left. Does that make any sense? It really doesn't. I mean, if you step back and go, you know, that doesn't make a whole lot of sense. Something's off here. Right? There's a lot of ways to shoot holes in this story. They didn't do it. All right? So point number three here in chapter 9 is the gullibility of Israel. You notice how they deftly avoided saying where they were from? Verse 11 says, we're from a far country and we're from a long way off. And where are you from? Well, we're from so far away that these shoes were new and these clothes were new and this bread was fresh when we left. They never directly answered the question. Those of you who have children, you know, have learned to kind of sort through some of that and, you know, keep driving at, you know, the answer that you really want. But we'll have to pick up there next week. We're about out of time. But what was the underlying problem here? I pointed out in verse 14 as we started in chapter 9. Why ultimately were they gullible? Well, they're gullible because they're human, but why did they fail? Verse 14 says, they asked not counsel at the mouth of the Lord. They fell for this, which, although they had rehearsed their story well, and apparently they were very personable, they were very charming, they were very good at their presentation, ultimately they failed because they didn't ask for God's wisdom. They didn't ask for God's direction. And don't we read that in James chapter 4, you have not because ye... Yeah. I mean, to me, this is like, yep, been there, done that. Made a mess because I didn't, you know, seek God's direction enough, or what, you know, we could all look at things and go, yep, yeah, I can identify with that. But this is God's reminder to us, don't repeat their mistakes. Don't make your own either, but don't repeat mistakes that are avoidable. We'll talk more about this next time, but we've got to close here for today. Thank you, Lord, for your word. Thank you for its timelessness and how your spirit can show us exactly what we need. Lord, I pray that you'd help us to remember that the things you do for us are for your glory and so that we can be a testimony. And Lord, I pray that you'd help us this week to have your direction and have your blessing. Lord, we pray now for our